As the 17-year-old Carl Rossmann, who had been sent to America by his unfortunate parents because a maid had seduced him and had a child by him, sailed slowly into New York Harbor, he suddenly saw the Statue of Liberty, which had already been in view for some time, as though in an intenser sunlight. The sword in her hand seemed only just to have been raised aloft, and the unchained winds blew about her form. "So high," he said to himself, and, quite forgetting to disembark, he found himself gradually pushed up against the railing by the massing throng of porters. You're listening to a podcast about buildings and cities. I'm Luke Jones.
And I'm George Gingell.
And we're talking about America, the first written and the last published of Franz Kafka's three novels, all of which were unfinished at the time of his death in 1924. America is an exploration of an imagined continent. Kafka himself never travelled further abroad than Paris. His impressions of the United States are a fantastic collage constructed out of newspaper articles, films, and the stories told by relatives, some of whom had been there themselves. Although Carl Rossmann's struggles contain many of what are thought of as Kafka's characteristic elements, entrapment, frustration, incomprehensible demands and motivations, they're balanced by vivid moments of beauty which unveil the awesome scale of huge new cities and revel in their delightful new technologies.
As you know, I learnt to read surprisingly late in life, in my sort of mid-teens. And before that, because of my particular difficulties with reading, I was given a special library card that entitled me to take out audiobooks for free from the library service. And they had a slightly strange range, and I listened to basically all of them. There was a lot of, like, Terry Pratchett, which was very well loved, and some sort of bits and bobs. And one of them was a collection of children's science fiction short stories, which was chosen by someone with a very strange sense of what children should be reading, because it included one work by Kafka, but I mean also amongst things like what I think is the Island of Dr. Moreau, or whatever that's called, one where it's all about like live vivisection, and then he's disappeared by an atomizing machine or something.
Yeah, the animals turned into kind of grotesque images of people. Sort of,
and it also had, by Franz Kafka, The Penal Colony. It's about a traveller, and he goes to this penal colony, and there's this giant like frame machine which was set up by the previous mad governor, which would pronounce everyone guilty and then, over the course of several hours, inscribe the words with blades into their bodies, which would cause them to die. Inscribe the words, all of the words of the laws that they had broken. And it turns out that this happens regardless of... this, by the way, is from memory from being nine, so perhaps, or whatever. and there is a man who likes to... who is the old operator, and there's a reforming regime. And it's mainly an interview between this sort of innocent traveller, who's a bit like the protagonist of America, with this guy who's trying to... You've got to persuade the governor. We've got to bring back the machine, this giant machine. And he's been tenderly loving it, and he says it's ecstatic. It's this moment of ecstasy. And in the end, they fail to persuade it. And he gets into the machine himself because he wants to experience the ecstasy. But the machine is broken and it just stabs him to death. And then it, like, rolls off a cliff. That was my first bit of Franz Kafka.
I kind of want to read it now.
Yeah, The Penal Colony. It's I don't know, actually, I don't really know. I mean, I had it... It fitted on... It can't be very long. It was one side of a cassette and one of these sort of big, you know, eight cassette.
When we say that it's unfinished, it's... All of the novels are unfinished, but it didn't require a great effort of editing to make them sort of conclude. The trial does end with the death of the protagonist. The castle, that feels like it's coming to an ending. America...
It feels like it's going... to the death of the protagonist. Definitely Kafka's favoured mode of conclusion.
Whereas with America, as we'll see, we don't even have a single ending. We have a fragmentation.
Yeah, it sort of fades out. And it doesn't fade out at the end. I think he would have imagined there being quite a bit more book.
We've got a teenage hero.
Yeah, there's a slight inconsistency about his age. But he's either 15, 16 or 17.
Something like that. And he's on this enormous boat, steaming into this imagined New York. The quotation we heard at the start contains this description of the Statue of Liberty, in which the torch of liberty has been substituted, by mistake or on purpose, for an enormous sword. What we're entering is this fantasy America, this sort of mirror world. I mean, does it make a difference that he's imagining America in 1913 rather than 1920?
Yes, I think it does. At the end of the 19th century and the first decade or so of the 20th century, there is a sort of American craze in Europe. America probably was becoming the sort of foremost economic power in the world between 1880 and 1900, and had a particular culture, and also was in many ways far in advance, particularly in its sort of, you know, most advanced parts, technologically and culturally, of Europe. He's growing up in the Grand Austro-Hungarian Empire.
Yeah.
Which is a very strange sort of state. And there are, you know, American bars popping up everywhere, which are often not very like anything you'd get in America. And people are trying to start to do things. The French have, for the first time, decided they're going to start doing things à l'américaine. At this point, people don't really know, and Americans haven't really come to Europe in any great numbers other than a sort of, you know, I mean, they have, but not...
Not in the numbers. That
not in the numbers. They're sort of, you know... And also, I would say, America still has... it's negotiable. You know, this is the period of sort of dollar princesses when, for some strange reason I don't really understand, to do with pride or a feeling of something, lots of, like, American heiresses are married to bankrupt European aristocrats, which ends about as well as you can imagine. But it's it happens a great many times. The key piece of insight is, in the 1920s, Europeans, by virtue of American engagement at the end of the war, and by virtue of the obvious preeminence of the American economy, had learnt a lot about America. Whereas in the run-up to the First War, particularly in somewhere not in the English-speaking world, Europeans could be fascinated by America, but wouldn't necessarily know very much about it at all.
The first chapter takes place on the ship, just to sketch the plot. It's this very characteristic series of seemingly small and ridiculous mishaps which kind of gradually spiral into a sort of greater and greater displacement. A young man, with whom he had struck up a slight acquaintance during the crossing, said to him in passing, "Well, don't you want to get off?" "I'm all ready," said Carl, laughing to him, and in his exuberance, and because he was a strong lad, he raised his suitcase onto his shoulder. But as he watched his acquaintance disappearing, along with the others, swinging a cane, he realised that he had left his umbrella down in the ship. Below deck, he found to his annoyance that a passage that would have considerably shortened the way for him was, for the first time, barred, probably something to do with the fact that all the passengers were disembarking, and so he was forced instead to make his way through numerous little rooms, along continually curving passages, and down tiny flights of stairs, one after the other, and then through an empty room, with an abandoned desk in it, until, eventually, only ever having gone this way once or twice previously, and then in the company of others, he found that he was totally and utterly lost.
I think the first chapter is a real masterpiece. The first chapter is taking several components, each of which kind of build up this sense of tension or complexity in the story. Yeah. And it's really having the other things in the back of your mind that makes it work. So he leaves his suitcases, all his worldly possessions, with this acquaintance he's not met, who doesn't want to wait, and then goes off on this enormous mission to get his umbrella, is immediately overtaken by various things, so you're starting to think about that. He's then getting lost, and you're like worrying about the umbrella and him being lost, and you're already very worried about him because he's going off to America as a teenager on his own, with no idea of what to do.
He gets lost. He knocks on a door to try and or rather a door is open and he sees someone through it, and he says, you know, "I'm lost, can you help me?" Gets talking to this guy who's the stoker. So the guy who stokes the coal boilers of the engines, I guess.
This guy is a mesmeric scene for me. Immediately what happens is he goes in, the door closes, and he's stuck in this tiny space. And there is one of these moments that are so common in Kafka, where the character is sort of possessed. his will is sort of sublimated into a scene, and he immediately finds himself lying on the stoker's bed in this strange intimacy.
Listening to all his complaints.
Listening to his complaints, the complaints of this stoker, who is a German stoker, and there is a dreadful Romanian chief engineer who has been treating him terribly. But the stoker is very strange. Not through any particular reason, our protagonist is immediately and magnetically seized by this totally uncharismatic and quite mad, almost grotesque.
But then also we encounter this thing about him, which is his innocence, and also this strange sort of gauche confidence that he has. So he sort of talks the stoker into going to talk to the chief cashier or the captain about the way in which he's been treated and how unacceptable it is, and that they'll be able to straighten it out if only they explain the situation.
Yeah, this is a really key difference from any other... I haven't read that much Kafka. I've read a few of the short stories. The situation's sort of the same, implausible traps, but the character is so jolly. He's not resigned to his fate. He's always, you know, something grotesque and ridiculous will happen, and he'll go, but don't you see, this is completely unreasonable.
Yeah.
All you have to do is stop doing this. Everything, we could all get on with our lives.
I think we're seeing two things which become very important. Like, the first thing he does in the story is he goes to the rail and he sort of stares in wonder at something. And he's constantly doing that all through this chapter. Whenever he gets within sight of a window, he has to sort of get distracted and peer out of it. And the other is, we've already got a sense of it, but this ship is unimaginably huge.
There's a lot of windows, but there's also a lot of photographs in this book. The minute analysis of images. It will examine a photograph, the character, and really pick up on like a series of tiny details. And that also is very clearly something that Kafka is doing, where he is taking an image, presumably things like photographs of America or images that have been established of America, and taking images and also magnifying and distorting them through his sensibility, but also through his particular sort of, you know, Kafkaesque sense, but also through an exaggeration and wonder. The taking of an image and intensifying it. But it means that again and again you get these sort of tableaux. He will see something which is a familiar image. You know, in a little bit, we will see the image of New York Harbour with all its towers and bustling boats and things. An image I can summon up in my mind. I know sort of black and white photographs of exactly what that looks like. And I think Kafka clearly does too. He's clearly taken an image, described it, but sort of put it through the Kafka filter.
The stoker knocked respectfully on the door, and when there was a shout of, "Come in," he motioned Carl to step in and not be afraid. Carl did so, but remained standing in the doorway. Through the three windows of the room, he could see the waves outside, and his heart pounded as he watched their joyful movement, as though he hadn't just spent the last 5 days doing nothing else. Great ships kept crossing paths, and yielded to the motion of the waves only insofar as their bulk allowed. If you narrowed your eyes, the ships seemed to be staggering under their own weight. On their masts were long but very narrow flags, which were pulled tight by their speed through the air. All that happens is that he and the stoker band together and they go to have it out with the hierarchy of the ship, and Carl is charged with this naive belief that he'll be able to... that, you know, justice will be done, that he'll be able to explain, even though he's never met this man before and he has absolutely no idea about the real circumstances of his conflict with the chief engineer.
Another thing that happens again and again, there's just continual trial sequences all the way through this. And it often, in this case, the stoker is completely inarticulate and you just feel this dread of our young protagonist, who is always very eloquent and a great speaker. And it's worth noting that... Kafka's job was he was a lawyer working for a personal injury insurance company whose job was to mainly assess industrial, small, you know, places where I think people have chopped off their fingers in the machine and things for the payout.
Mm.
So he is continually going, interviewing workers who have been injured and dealing with the hierarchy. That's the basis of his job. This sort of scene just comes up again and again and again and again. And the various anxieties of it, the inability of people to explain their circumstance, the excessive emphasis on points, people's passion, fear, the importance of it to them overcoming their ability to communicate in various ways. And he's very good on the style, you know, that people's emotions will get in the way of clear communication.
In the meantime, the life of the harbour was going on outside the windows, a flat barge carrying a mountain of barrels, which must have been miraculously laden so as not to start rolling, passed by and plunged the room into near darkness. Little motorboats, which Carl would have been in a good position to examine if he'd had the leisure, pursued their dead straight courses, responsive to every twitch of the hands of the men standing up at their wheels. Strange floats surfaced occasionally from the turbulent water, only to become swamped again and sink astonishingly from sight. Boats from the great liners were rowed ashore by toiling sailors, full of passengers, who obediently kept their places and sat quietly and expectantly, even though a few couldn't refrain from turning their heads this way and that to look at the changing scene. All was endless movement, a restlessness communicated by the restless element to the helpless men and their works. But then this very surreal thing happens, which is that one of the too many men who are standing in the room, someone who's come to talk to the captain, asks Carl's name and turns out to be his uncle Jacob, who is the state senator or a state senator for New York. And this is like this extremely weird, in a sense, it's a kind of deus ex machina, you know, it pulls him out of this situation in which he's managed to lose not only his umbrella, but also his suitcase, and kind of get stuck in an argument somewhere deep in the bowels of the ship when he's meant to be disembarking. And there are one or two benevolent characters in this book. This is one of them. One of the things about them is that whenever he encounters them, it seems as if it's suggested that they're imposters, although that never turns out to be the case. So the uncle claims to be called Edward Jacob, but he knew his uncle from home. His first name was Jacob. He was Jacob something or other. So there's this sort of, and he doesn't recognise him. So there's this strange kind of sense of like, who is this guy who's claiming to be my uncle?
I saw that in the notes, and I sort of thought it was funny, but I hadn't thought about that very much. And there are points later where this sort of thing happens, and I was trying to think, what's this about? And I think a key element of it in creating the sense of unease, this first chapter is incredibly uneasy because of these small things like leaving the suitcase.
The suitcase is it's gone. It's gone.
No, it's not. He's always worrying about it. There's always this chance it might be there. It hasn't been that long.
Yeah.
But he's left it with this person he doesn't know. And he's swept up with great fortune with these people, but it always seems by a very slender and shaky thread that they...
And they don't retrieve the suitcase. They just leave together and go down into this.
No, you're not told about it for a lot. Yeah. It would just crop up again later, but not for...
Yeah, the suitcase and the Verona salami, which it's said to contain, which he's very anxious to hold on to.
Yes, he wants to give it to the... to give part of it to the stoker because he knows that such working class people are very impressed by small gifts, which his father... I mean, do you know about Kafka's dad? I read the sum total of my research for this episode is reading Franz Kafka's Wikipedia entry.
Yeah,
which is quality of sort of his dad, a massive, domineering, loud man who was a self-made, certainly prosperous, and was in the honourable trade of being a fancy goods retailer with a large shop.
Yeah.
But was completely mad, and he would do things like impetuously sack all his staff. And Kafka's had a memory of being sent round all of the working class Czech districts in Prague, having to go to each of the houses of his dad's employees and try and persuade them one by one to return to work as a sort of young teenager.
Yeah.
And it's this sort of mad, domineering, impetuous dad. Psychoanalyzing or sort of reading the symbolism of this. It's you can't do it because it's too glib and sort of obvious. It's like there's a one of do you know his fables? They're very short. They're like, you know, like 50 word stories by Kafka. One of which is about a mouse, and the mouse is like, when I was young, the world seemed impossibly vast, but now also soon the walls close in, and ahead of me is the trap which I will walk into. And then the cat said, but you can always turn and ate the mouse. And it's funny and it's a good joke. But also, like, it's like the sort of Freudian analysis of this book. It's so obvious. What's the symbolism?
At another level, a lot of things are kind of mysterious.
I had a little thing to say about symbolism and the sword. It definitely means that we're in a strange and different world, that the Statue of Liberty is holding a sword aloft. It definitely means it's strange, because everyone knows the Statue of Liberty. It's incredibly famous, and everyone knows Liberty carries a torch. It's a well-known symbol. There are lots of women symbols who carry swords.
Justice.
Justice is one of them, and the sort of crueler element of justice, and that's a kind of obvious interpretation. But it isn't necessary that it means that. Or, and also at a more basic level, a sword can just be that force of violence.
Yeah.
Or it could be an allusion to justice. Or, because it's ambiguous, you can put loads of interpretations on it. You know, throughout this book, he's always... there are all these, like, powerful women who are overcoming him.
So Carl Rossmann then has this very unusual welcome to America, which is that he is immediately adopted by a fabulously wealthy uncle who he never knew he had.
Fabulously wealthy and utterly mysterious.
The uncle is very much one of these domineering father figures. He clearly has a vision for what he wants Carl to be. Though it's stressed how important it is for him to do certain things, to have his English lesson, to have his horse riding lesson.
To not look out of the window too much in case his mind gets sort of melted.
Yes. But in other ways, the uncle's demands are mysterious. Carl doesn't really understand what the uncle wants, and that's going to become important later in the chapter and in the next one. If we're doing this in a spatial way, the next place of the novel is Carl's bedroom in this enormous, fabulous house in New York with his uncle, Jacob. There are lots of things which are lovely about this chapter. I think it has some of the most beautiful writing in the book, and it also has some really great, like, technological inventiveness. A narrow balcony ran along the entire length of the room, but what would probably have been the highest vantage point in Carl's hometown here did not afford much more than a view of a single street, which ran in a dead straight line between two rows of lopped-off houses until it vanished in the distance where the massive forms of a cathedral loomed out of the haze. In the morning and evening, and in his dreams at night, that street was always full of swarming traffic. Seen from above, it appeared to be a swirling kaleidoscope of distorted human figures, and the roofs of vehicles of all kinds, from which a new and amplified and wilder mixture of noise, dust, and smells arose. And all of this was held and penetrated by a mighty light that was forever being scattered, carried off, and eagerly returned by the multitudes of objects, and that seemed so palpable to the confused eye that it was like a sheet of glass spread out over the street that was continually and violently smashed.
Like, you can see it immediately, even though he's using very abstract language. Part of the reason you can see it is because you know the picture. Like, the only way I know New York is from pictures. This picture's a really famous one, isn't it? You're, like, in one of those sort of apartment buildings, and you look, that, like, sort of obliquely down the street.
Yeah.
And you see
these kind of atmospheric
you
effects.
You see, firstly, this kind of wall of buildings. And when he says house, it's... In German, I think an apartment building is a house.
I think also he imagines that the guy just has an enormous house.
Yeah, but it's all offices. It's not his home. The uncle doesn't live there, I don't think. Or maybe he does, but he doesn't live...
I mean, yeah, that uncle's house is kind of like a sort of classic urban palace, isn't it? Of the kind that we've been discussing in other...
Yeah.
In other episodes. It's got all the... You live on top of the business, but just in this enormously grand... way.
And it's got that, like, when we were talking about skyscrapers, I don't know if we actually got around to talking about, like, you know, the whole building is this machine where humans and technology are integrated into this huge stack, you know, with operators at one level which have sort of machinery bolted onto them. And
his quarters are full of these fantastic bits of technology. This is where I think he must have been reading magazines or seeing it in...
I think guidebooks.
Yeah.
I think travel books.
So this one, he talks about his desk. Of course, his desk was nothing like those so-called American desks that turn up at European auctions. For instance, the top part of it had 100 different compartments of all sizes, so that even the President of the Union would have found room for each of his files in it. But even better than that, it had an adjuster at the side, so that by turning the handle, one could rearrange and adjust the compartments in whatever way one wanted or needed. With just one turn of the handle, the appearance of the top would be completely transformed, and one could do it either slowly or at incredible speed, depending on how one turned the handle.
It's an impossible thing. It's this sort of adjusting file system that's you crank with a handle. Everything is cranked with a handle. And later on, his uncle gets him a piano, and he's sent down to assist in bringing the piano up. And they wheel it into the enormous service lift, which is in the core of the building,
yeah.
And is entirely glass.
Yeah.
And he gets into the lift next to it, which is also entirely glass.
Yeah.
And he sort of guides his lift up at the same speed so that he can see the piano moving up the building in its glass box, using the lever to sort of... it's really fun.
I mean, they would have had lifts in Prague, couldn't they, at this point? Maybe one...
I'm not sure they would have had any.
Really?
Prague... We had... There were a few lifts in London, probably five or ten or something.
So he might never have seen one.
I mean, lifts start in the 1860s, but they were basically unknown in... He was from Prague, which is sort of, the third city of the Austro-Hungarian Empire. I mean, it does have industry. It's an industrial city, but I don't think it would have happened. Yeah, I mean, there may have been lifts somewhere, but not... I mean, even after the First War, there were places where you'd have an exhibition or you'd have a grand room, and people would go just to go up and down a little lift, which would probably only go up one floor. People installed lifts in shops in London, I think, quite big ones.
To get people in?
Yeah, so people would come in and they'd go up one floor in the shop, in the lift, and people would, go up and down in the lifts. And that was happening...
That's happening at this point, yeah.
Or even later, lifts are very exciting. I mean, the lift really was this American, Otis and a couple of the other companies really developing. I mean, we talked about all the sort of insane schemes people had in the early days for the water weight lift and things.
Yeah, all these. He seems to rather love technology, certainly at this point.
He loved it all his life. One of his short stories is just him talking about how great aeroplanes are. He sort of wanted to be an aeroplane engineer.
Yeah, well, Carl is constantly saying how he wants to be an engineer in
I mean, most of Kafka's protagonists are very heavily Kafka.
Yeah.
Put through a lens.
They're normally called something like... K. In this recent new translation of The Castle, they've changed all the name of the protagonist from K to Car, which apparently is more true to the original manuscript. Yeah, so this chapter is full of all of this technological stuff, and I kind of want to do other bits of it because they're so kind of magical and filled with this sort of naive wonder. There's the shower, which he has, which is described in this amazing way.
That. My God, it's such a pimped shower. These do exist, by the way, but you have to install one hell of a lot of water infrastructure to make them work.
He has to go on these riding lessons, which he rather sort of hates, but because he just wants to stay and look out the window the whole time and maybe play the piano occasionally. Before going to his riding lesson, he has a go in the shower. The sieve of a shower extended over the whole length and breadth of the bathtub. And Carl would lie stretched out. He could even spread his arms in the tub and let streams of warm, hot, and finally ice-cold water descend on him, all or part, just as he liked.
It's lovely. It's this huge bath with a huge, rain shower in it.
Yeah, but the size of the whole enormous... Yeah. He can spread it. The bath must be 2 metres wide or something.
And... Insane. Back 8 years ago when I was working with... A company, there was the recession, so we were just doing rich people's houses, basically. They were so gagging for it. They would, but the amount of, logistics, people would end up spending, £80,000 in order to have one of these things, because you have to, have a whole, huge cold water tank, because no one has a cold water supply that's big enough, and then, this row of boilers. the system tank boilers wouldn't be big enough, so you'd have to have a cascade of tanks, pressure tanks,
yeah.
And then a cold, huge cold tank.
Really, you need the heated bathtub, though, because you don't want to get into the bathtub and have it cold.
Oh, I haven't come across those.
It was a special kind which you could get for your cast iron bathtub, which was just like a kind of kettle element that was attached to the bottom of the bathtub.
You'd want to earth the bathtub very thoroughly, wouldn't you?
Yeah. Well, that was the point of failure. And there's a famous photo of a man who'd been continuously cooked in his for about a week.
Oh, wow. Is it like the... have you come across the electric tablecloth? It's one of these in the Science Museum. This is a fantastic product from the turn of the century. It's like a tablecloth, and it's got a wire mesh.
Yeah.
And then there's a blanket, and then there's another wire mesh. And you plug the, like... live and neutral terminals
into the opposite side.
As long as you don't make contact between them, it's okay. And then all your electrical appliances, like your toaster and your like candlesticks with lamps on them and stuff, have got spikes on the bottom, and you stab them through and they make the connections.
That's good, isn't it?
It's good. If you get it wet, you'll have electricity going straight through you.
Yeah, this was a real era of mod cons, though, wasn't it? I mean,
that's such a mod con.
I sort of imagine him in him like reading whatever the sort of Czech or German version of like Popular Science Monthly or whatever.
Oh, he's definitely doing that, and he'd go down to Italy where they were doing great things. I think also the Germans were. Buda had the world's second underground railway and stuff.
Well, that was a kind of this weird undercurrent that was going on in the otherwise incredibly old-fashioned and pompous Austro-Hungarian Empire. It's one of the things which Josef Roth writes about in this very wistful way, is the way that you had this sort of the kind of new bright railway stations in these incredibly backwards rural places, all with the same like yellow insignia and things. They seemed like this incredibly kind of modern, this avatar of kind of modern life and values cropping up in this place, which was essentially still medieval.
You know, around Prague and the sort of German-speaking areas of Bohemia, there was really, you know, there was Skoda, and there were these really advanced industrial complexes. But next to them, there are people wearing, like, homespun medieval clothes pushing ploughs in fields.
The end of this chapter, in a way, is an inversion of the end of the first chapter. We have another strange man who comes to the house, Mr. Polander, one of his uncle's business associates or acquaintances or whatever, insists that he comes to dinner at his house and to have dinner with him and his daughter, Clara. The whole scene where this happens is so weird, because the uncle obviously doesn't want it to happen, but also doesn't feel able to say that it shouldn't happen, or what is going on? It's so strange.
He says like, well, you'll only be able to go for the evening and it won't be worth it.
But it's this incredibly strong subtext which you can't understand what it is really.
Yeah.
Like, which is there as the kind of control is there, but there's no real agenda. It's very strange.
There's lots of controlling dads and there's lots of dominant women.
I mean, we're about to meet one. So the transition is this, you know, this long car journey where little Carl falls asleep like a sort of... He kind of goes between trying to act like an adult and behaving like a very small child, doesn't he? He kind of just, like, drifts off to sleep like a little baby. They're another big rich family, but they live far out of the city. We're into the third chapter, and this is where it gets sexy, but in a really strange way.
There's already been one really strange sexy bit.
Which one?
We can
that?
Compare the two women.
Oh, yeah, well, we had the reminiscence of him impregnating the maid. Should we do that bit?
I think it's really important. I think the analysis of the different women situations... In the scene on the boat at the end, it comes out that his uncle has heard about this. And then we have a flashback. So they're in their little sort of pokey apartment, which has a maid. And his main memory of her is she's got a tiny little side room. And she prays all the time in the side room to a little crucifix. And he feels this strange distance to her. And then one day, she sort of starts stroking him.
Mm.
And takes him into her room. So he becomes sort of limp.
Yeah, he's completely passive,
isn't
he? He's
completely passive, and she's just sort of stroking him.
And she puts him in his in
and
her
she
bed.
She puts him in her bed and undresses him. And he's just sort of mesmerised. And there's some like really unsexy details. I can't remember them. It's extreme. He's like sort of rigid in the bed. And
there are no genitals, there are just their bellies. The only body part which is referred to is their like bellies pressing together.
And then at the end, he just sort of flees.
Yeah, and cries.
And cries.
Yeah. I mean, he is presumably, like, 14 at the time these happening, so...
Yeah, something like that. Yeah. Her caresses of him are completely, like, motherly or matronly. And her characteristics are this... She's very quiet, she's very submissive, and she's very religious. It's a really weird scene, but I think that comes straight out of his childhood. I think that's him, like, as a 14-year-old, either fantasizing or, like, being... Because that is... They lived in a little flat with a maid. All of this stuff, it doesn't come from nowhere.
We get a quite different kind of woman in this third chapter, little Clara, who is a bit of a sex pot, actually, isn't she?
Yeah.
There's this great little... He has this amazing sentence. "Such red lips she has," Carl said to himself, and he thought of Mr. Polunder's lips and how beautiful they had become in his daughter. Yeah, she has this lovely yellow dress.
Sheer and, like, tight, and he's always seeing things under the dress.
They're there for dinner, aren't they?
But there's this horrible man who's come along.
Oh, yeah, Mr. Green, who's been mentioned before as well. He's another business associate, but he's this enormous man who smokes a cigar. Like an enormous cigar. Everything about him is huge and kind of animal, and he takes up all the space. During dinner, Carl is at certain points, he's sort of battling Mr. Green for the attention of Clara.
This is another great Kafka theme, is the sort of exchange of women amongst men. And the other thing sex is always like with reference to someone else. Being jealous of you, or you being jealous of them.
The two of them sneak off after dinner and go wandering around this house, which is almost all dark. There's hardly any electricity in it.
There's one room which is really bright and modern, and then the rest of it's like Gormenghast. Yeah. It's like full of these complicated dark corridors, which suddenly gusts of wind go down and huge, and suddenly you're in a huge vaulted room without a wall and stuff.
Yeah, yeah, there's this later moment where he goes off wandering and literally comes to the end of the house, you know, is open to the elements. He has to be guided back by a helpful servant who appears. Clara put out her hand to push open a door in passing and said, "This is where you'll be sleeping." Of course, Carl wanted to take a look in the room right away, but Clara explained, almost shouting with impatience, that that could wait, that he was to come along now. They had a little tug of war in the corridor. Finally, Carl thought he mustn't do just whatever Clara said, and he broke loose and ran into the room. It was surprisingly dark outside, because just beyond the window was a treetop, which was swaying to and fro. There was birdsong. In the room itself, which the moonlight hadn't penetrated, one could make out very little. Carl was sorry he hadn't brought along the electric torch his uncle had given him. He sat down on the window seat and looked and listened. A frightened bird seemed to drill its way through the foliage of the old tree. The whistle of a New York suburban train sounded somewhere out in the distance. Apart from that, all was quiet. Whenever he has these like little moments of autonomy, what he does is sort of sink into this absorption in surrounding phenomena. In which, you know, the bird song, everything disappears and the bird song creeps in.
And it's wonderful. It's, you know, there's a wonder in the situation and the thing. But then Clara comes in.
She's really pissed off and she does all this, like, jujitsu on him.
Like, so what happens is he's like, "Oh, no, I don't want to go to your room." She's all day she's been sort of footseeing with Mr. Green, but then telling him he's got to come to her room. Yeah. And he's like, he sort of pushes her back. And she's like, "Let me go, and I'll have a surprise for you." And the surprise is she's going to get, like, wrestled and pinned to the floor. And she's going to go, "I'm going to beat you up, or perhaps I'm not. Or perhaps if I do, it will just make me feel worse. But if I don't, but actually perhaps I should, because if you don't, you'll just feel even more humiliated because the girl's beaten you up. Yeah. But even if I do, it will be the same."
Well, I mean, he's, like, pinned to the floor
for
quite a long time.
And she said, "Well, you're a big guy, but you're strong, and maybe if you study jiu-jitsu..."
No, she's like this kind of Krav Maga girl, like, beating the crap out of him, doing all of her special moves. And but then even when he's, like, pinned to the floor and can't move, then there's this moment where the light of the candle starts to wash against the ceiling and he, like, again, is sinking into the blue and white striped...
Well, she's, like, pinning him down, going, "I'm going to slap you on both sides of your head." Yeah.
But he's, like, drifting into the background again. It's so strange and beautiful and, you know, And they don't know what to make of it. Eventually, they do go to her room eventually, and then her fiancé is there.
In the next room, like, the whole thing, apparently, the whole reason why she wanted to get him into her room, like, he's instructed, like, forced to play the piano for her, which he doesn't do very well, and then her fiancé, who's his friend, but he didn't know was her fiancé, sort of claps in the next room and goes, well, this was all just so that I could hear you play the piano, and it's really weird.
Yeah, and he's just been waiting. He wasn't at dinner. He's just been waiting there in the shadows.
He's been waiting there in the shadows, like in his giant bed.
And then at the end of the chapter, this really weird thing happens, which is that he is collared by Mr. Green.
Because he wanted to leave. He wanted to get out.
Yeah.
I can't. I've been so insulted by these people. Clara's beaten the crap out of me. And Mr. Green says, you've got to stay here till midnight, and then I'll let you go, and then I can tell you something special.
Yeah, but he can't leave because the car's gone, and they can't, you know, there's no train or whatever, and, like, he's convinced not to go. But then at midnight, Mr. Green gives him a letter from his uncle. The letter from his uncle says, well, unfortunately, because you disobeyed my wishes by going to see Mr. Pollander, I'm afraid I can never see you again.
And you didn't return by midnight. That's it. It's like, if he had returned by midnight, it's fine. But because he hasn't returned by midnight, because Mr. Green has been waiting with the letter and saying, I'll give this to you at midnight, you can't go.
But Mr. Green also, in this kind of magician's trick, produces the suitcase and umbrella, which have been missing since he'd disembarked the boat.
And he's got him a third-class rail ticket to go down south.
No, to go to San Francisco.
Yeah, which is somehow on the southeastern seaboard of the United States.
After leaving the house, he goes to an inn, where he ends up being put in a room with these two kind of tramps, Robinson and Delamarche, who are respectively Irish and French.
And they're rakes.
They are, yeah, they're a bit... They do rather take advantage of him, don't they?
They eat his Viennese his Verona sausage.
Which has imparted its smell to everything in the suitcase.
And basically, like, order dinners and get him to pay for them.
They've got this idea that they're going to go somewhere...
They're going to go to some town where there's lots of work.
We're outside, suddenly, for the first time in the book. And really the only time. They're walking alongside a highway into which are going all of the trucks transporting the food for New York. And he describes this scene of looking through fog. The highway is this, like, impassable, constant stream of trucks, but he imagines them all as sort of, like, flatbeds, in the back of which are stacked, like, milk bottles, kind of peasant women who are coming in for market day.
And also, all the cars have got big open doors, like carriages, with the doors taken off. They're sort of in a traffic jam where people just walk through the moving cars.
He's worried about his money and showing them how much money he has. And also, he hasn't slept at all. Instead of going to sleep, he, like, stares intently at this photograph of his parents, which he's examining in minute detail.
Yeah, and these would have been quite tiny photographs, which happens several times in the book. And he's sort of picking out the minute relationships and talking about other photographs that he doesn't have. I think he's very interested in them as literary devices. I think there is a relationship between, throughout his work, the static scenes of several people, where there's a whole list of people, more than you would normally put in a scene, each of whom is described in turn, and they are all engaged in an activity, but the activity is static in the sense that kids are running around, but they're all kind of in the instant of running around for quite a long time. Or, you know, a man is standing in the back, pacing backwards and forwards and thwacking his sort of a leg with his cane, but he's doing that for, like, a really extended period of action, which is actually like a photograph. It's like the action is captured, but it's captured in a static way.
That's the thing which happens so much in this novel, is that the protagonist is captured by the vision of people or machines engaged in a sort of happy and purposeful activity, in which they seem to have none of the kind of self-doubt or kind of self-awareness or sort of reflexive kind of embarrassment, which he feels in everything.
But the stasis is part of that. The distance, but the alienation is, like, between him looking at the picture, looking at it like a photograph. There is a huge subconscious in this book, but the characters have... There is no inner character in any of the characters. The characters are all completely flat. And the whole thing is suffused by Franz Kafka's subconscious. The situation with the women isn't because of an overarching drive on behalf of the inner lives of the characters. It's because of a fretful or fantastical or dreamlike experience of Franz Kafka.
The psyche is the world, isn't it? The psyche isn't any of the characters. It's the world that the characters
don't have inner lives, really. Even the protagonist doesn't really have a... Like, the statement never goes beyond a sentence, and there's no real change in his character.
So he's with these tramps, then they go to various places where they spend his money. He gets sent off to go and find some dinner, and then he goes into this place called the Hotel Occidental, and there he meets another of these rare benevolent characters, the head cook, who's this enormous fat woman. But again, we have this strange intimation that she may be an imposter of some kind, because she claims to be German, and she claims that she also worked in Prague, but rather than speaking English with a German accent, she speaks German with an English accent in this kind of curious inversion.
But it's not that she's an imposter, it's that it's plausibly strange.
At the moment that someone seems to be saving him, you have this sort of moment of terror about who are they and why do they want to do it. That benevolence is, I think benevolence in this book is in a way also a violation. It's as much of a violation as people chucking him out or nicking his stuff or kind of traducing his intentions or accusing him of things that he hasn't done or judging him in all sorts of ways. They're all the same.
Yeah.
They're all these kind of unwanted exercises of will that more powerful people do to him. I think it also plays into this sense that he feels very much like a child. Like, it feels like Kafka has a powerful memory of what it's like to be a small child who people are always, like, gathering you up and sort of smothering you and feeding you when you don't want to be fed. And all of these things that you don't have any control. Yeah. And when the head cook is like, no, you're going to come here and you're going to be a lift boy.
It's also not just that people are doing things to him, but his desires are very childlike. And other characters have the same sorts of things. There's a bit when there's a character who wants to appear really sick so that people like... And he's not going to tell anyone. He just wants to die and everyone will feel sorry. That's a child emotion.
So, I mean, he does become a lift boy at the hotel. And this is... The book is cyclical. And one of the speculations people have about when it was meant to be finished, you know, how many of these cycles... Would it have cycled again? Would it have, would it have gone through several more of these? But this is in a way, is the twin of his period in the uncle's flat, where he now has a place again, and he sort of knows what he's doing. He's a lift boy and he gets tips and he goes up and down on his lifts.
He starts off at the top of a stratified society where he is a consumer.
Yeah.
And he goes through his uncle's office and watches all these people who are components in the machine of this office of mysterious purpose, you know, who are sort of literally strapped into machines doing machine-like tasks. And then he becomes one of them. And not, I don't think it's something that we should emphasise, but I don't think we can completely ignore the political commentary.
So there's a really good introduction where one of the things that Michael Hoffman speculates about is, you know, possibly he's meant to go around the plug hole a couple more times and sort of sink lower and then sort of sink lower again. So the lift boy episode also contains, this is my other favourite description, Carl's been having like this incredibly hard day at the office as the lift boy, driving the lift up and down. You know, he's had to do two lifts at the same time in some rather implausible way. And then he has a moment where everything is settled down and he's able to take a moment for himself. It says, after 4 o'clock, there was a small lull, and not before time. Carl leaned against the railing beside his lift, slowly eating his apple, from which a strong, sweet aroma rose from the very first bite, and looked down the lift shaft, which was surrounded by the large windows of the storerooms, behind which great bunches of bananas glimmered faintly in the dark. So there's this kind of quite slightly magical fantasy of the lift shaft as this, you know, this is the lift shaft as a light well. Everyone looks into the lift shaft.
Well, the two rakes, Robinson reappears.
Very drunk.
Carl is in a panic. He wants him out. He doesn't want to deal with him. He cannot be seen with him. He wants to bribe him to go. He disappears to get money. He comes back. He's completely hammered. and he like vomits into the lift shaft, and Carl's getting more and more terrified, and then he like collapses in a corner and won't move, and he just like dashes him away to the dormitory where all the, which is a great,
you know, the Hotel Occidental is where it's one of this whole series of like unfeasibly vast bureaucratic institutions. It's got 30 lifts, it's got like hundreds of lift boys, and they all live together in an enormous dormitory. Robinson is a kind of a clown figure, and then he like ends up get like antagonizing and being beaten to a pulp by all of the other lift boys who are like fine strong young men.
They're all great pugilists.
All of this is enough for some other member of staff to cast these aspersions about Carl and what he must have been up to.
Well, his boss sort of finds him out in stages.
There's the judge, who's his friend, and then there's the kind of prosecutor. His friend, the head cook, and his prosecutor, the head waiter, or whoever it is, who are...
But they're also, like, suddenly in love, and, like, really sort of generally, this enormously fat cook and this enormously thin head waiter.
Yeah.
Are like sort of caressing each other.
But you know, he's accusing him of all sorts of things which he hasn't done, but which are vaguely suggested by this strange incident which has happened.
It's like, it's another one of these real like, oh my, you just feel your heart sinking. It's even worse than leaving the suitcase. And he feels so ashamed of these people who've been nice to him, and that, and this woman is crying because he's in threat, and then like it looks like he's done. And someone rushes in and says something even worse has happened as a consequence of this. Some other terribly important person has been inconvenienced. I'm like, oh, this man is like, this is rampaging person.
Saying, just rampaging drunk.
And there's another terrible thing will happen, and it's just, you're like, oh my god, this is so bad.
He's got to take Robinson home, and then it, like, immediately he's finding his third sort of moment of stasis. We're getting to a point where the book is going to fragment. The third scene is this apartment with this kind of rather faded singer called Brunelda.
Faded singer is one possible description.
Yeah, I don't know. It's really weird. But so one of the kind of partner tramp of Robinson, this guy Delamarche, has seduced her, and they're all living together in this bizarre and impossible apartment. And Carl is to be her sort of cleaner and servant.
We've gone into like a sadomasochistic nightmare.
Yeah.
Suddenly he's gone from being boss class to being worker class, and now he's like slave. She's this enormous corpulent body, neurotically bossing people around. You're gonna kill me, you're killing me. The apartment is kind of like, it's like a horrific vision of the Villa Straylight. There's this big room, and it's just full of boxes and piled up, and the curtains are always closed, and she's lying on this enormous sofa.
And it's full of, like, theatrical props of various kinds.
Yeah.
One bed is an enormous pile of carpets and kind of weird stuff. The bed which Carl is allowed to lie down on for a bit is an enormous pile of curtains. Him and Robinson have to go and sit out on the balcony for hours
but
on
Robinson,
end.
Like, these characters have changed. Now, whatever he's called, I keep thinking, now I'm thinking Delacroix.
Delamarche.
Delamarche is dressed in these natty suits and is bizarrely like, has got this really weird sex thing going on with the lady. In the morning he gets up and he's got to bathe her, and the others have got to like cower behind this, and she's constantly, oh, killing me, we scrub harder. He just sees all the bits of bodies, and then they're making out, and then there's more of that, and that's sort of thrashing around, and all the time she's like lying with her legs spread open.
They get sent out onto the balcony when those sort of moments are happening. But then Robinson, this is this kind of weird child sexuality again, that like all what he really wants is, he just wants to catch a glimpse of her, of her like nakedness.
And once she touched his cheek,
yeah,
and he says, if you have ever have any opportunity, you really must. You really must have her touch your cheek.
Yeah, well, Carl doesn't want to become the slave, but he's sort of beaten repeatedly until he like has no alternative. So while they're out on the balcony, he has the opportunity to look the other way and to stare out at the city. This is what he sees. The street, so empty by day, was now crammed full of people. Especially the entrances to the buildings. Everyone was in slow, cumbersome movement. The shirt sleeves of the men and the light dresses of the women stood out a little from the darkness. The many balconies round were all occupied now. There, by the light of an electric lamp, sat families. The men sat there, legs apart, feet pushed through the railings, reading newspapers that reached down almost to the floor, while they played cards, apparently wordlessly, but smacking the cards down powerfully on the table. The women had their laps full of mending. A frail blonde woman on the next balcony kept yawning, rolling her eyes as she did and covering her mouth with a garment she was just patching. Even on the smallest balconies, children seemed able to chase one another. Gramophones had been put on inside many of the rooms and pumped out vocal or orchestral music. At some of the windows you could see completely motionless lovers. One such couple stood at a window facing Carl. The young man had his arm around the girl and was squeezing her breast with his hand.
Well, for me, the core of that, I feel he must have a traveller's description of people staying on the fire escape stairs of New York tenements. I think this must be a traveller has gone and written a book. There must be a book or something, or a magazine article. Like in the summers when it was very hot, people would sleep out on the escape stairs, and there's a sort of mythos around this.
Yeah.
But then what he's done is he's made it weird as well, but also like a photograph again. This thing of still static lovers, or the scene is in action but static. Particularly when you're talking about modernist fiction, you can feel that the influence of books should be literary, Joyce or T.S. Eliot, or which is sort of steeped in the Western canon, and you're meant to be like making out these semi-occluded references. I think Franz Kafka is absolutely not like that, but I still think it's full of literature. It's just sort of technical travelogue, magazine-y.
And at the level of image as well.
And image, yeah.
Image. It's sort of image rather than language. I mean, there's more to it. We won't describe everything. There's this whole like outdoor scene then sort of segues into this kind of urban pageant. There's someone who's trying to be elected as a judge. His followers are getting into a fight with someone else's kind of supporters. All of this plays out in front of him, and he gets into a conversation with the person on the next balcony who advises him that maybe it's not such a bad idea to be the servant of these strange people who he's staying with. But we never really find out what that's going to be like, because that's the end of the book. What we have after that is this series of fragments, one of which is about Brunelda. They carry Brunelda down the stairs, put her in this wagon where she's covered...
It's a bath chair.
Where she's covered with a cloth, and then he has to pull... He's, like, pulling the chair on wheels.
She's being sort of smuggled out into a mysterious institution, which is also seedy and weird.
Yeah, not that much to say about that one. There's a second fragment which is all like, which seems much more like the start of the next bit of the book. On a street corner, Carl saw a poster with the following announcement. At the racecourse in Clayton, today from 6 a.m. till midnight, personnel is being hired for the theatre in Oklahoma. The Great Theatre of Oklahoma is calling you. It's calling you today only. If you miss this opportunity, there will never be another.
This section's really good and very strange. And actually, I was feeling quite ill when I was... I've had a cold for a week, and I was tired and ill. And the end, for me, just became so ominous, which I think may be a completely different interpretation. But what happens is he's found this amazing poster. That was the beginning. He's like, oh, great. Life is clearly, he's been having a bad time. There's been other terrible jobs and things that have happened in the meantime.
He arrives at this, like, hiring thing. It's this enormous setup with, like, bizarrely
in
few
the local
people
race
there. Yeah, bizarrely few people are there. The first thing you see when you get out there are all of this... This is this very famous image. All of these women standing on huge pedestals blowing trumpets. Mm. And they're of all different heights. And he meets a woman... there's a bit of a continuity problem here, because he meets a woman called Fanny, who we've not met in the book at all, but who one you sort of assume maybe she's the same person as Therese, who he made friends with in the hotel or something like that.
Oh, I thought she might be the same person as Clara.
He briefly goes up her pedestal, there's a little spiral staircase which opens at the bottom of it, and he goes up to talk to her and then comes back down again. They have in like enormous dresses which go all the way down to cover the whole pedestal. And
walking up her dresses.
Yeah, I know.
And she's like, oh, every like few hours, you should get a job here. It's really nice. Every few hours, they all the women with angels are replaced by men dressed as devils with trumpets. And because he's done a little, he's played her trumpet for a little bit, and everyone stopped and listened to him brilliantly playing the trumpet, which is a really superior instrument, of which they're all abusing, like, with their, because none of the women playing trumpets know how to play the trumpet.
Yeah, but I mean, he eventually guides everyone and they get lined up in a queue and then go in to be processed and to apply for jobs. The reason they've taken over the race course is because they have jobs for everyone, and there's a special office for every different kind of person. It's described that they take over all of the little huts of the bookmakers, where you go to bet, all these like tiny little structures all the way alongside, and all of each one is for a different person. And you know, he goes first to, because he has this rather obscure kind of secondary qualification from Europe.
No, first he says, "I'm an engineer," because he wants to be an engineer, and he says that, and he steps forward, and then every single man steps forward. And then then the person says, "Are you really engineers?" And all the other people step back. Utterly bizarre. And the person's like, and he looks at him and thinks, we sort of have the mind of the person looking, and thinks, this person cannot be an engineer. But he brought all of the other people here, so he's good. First he goes to that, the engineering one, and then he goes to the office for technical people. Yeah. And then he goes to another office, and then he goes to the office for people who were previously went to secondary school in Europe.
Yeah.
No, they take him on, and then that person asks, so what do you think you'd be happiest doing? And he's like, well, I got employed as an actor, didn't I? And he goes, what would you be happiest doing? He says, well, I want to be an engineer. Well, we might not be able to sort that out for you immediately, but we'll get you a technical job, and you'll be off as an engineer in a jiffy.
And then it stops again, and then there's another tiny fragment. It's less than a page. He's met up in some mysterious way with someone that he used to work at the hotel with, this former lift boy called Giacomo. They rode for 2 days and two nights. Only now did Carl begin to grasp the size of America. He looked out of the window tirelessly, and Giacomo craned towards it with him until the youths opposite, more interested in playing cards, had had enough and gave him the window seat opposite. On the first day, they travelled over a high mountain range. Blue-black formations of rock approached the train in sharp wedges. Narrow, dark, cloven valleys opened. With a finger, they traced the direction in which they disappeared. Broad mountain streams came rushing like great waves on their hilly courses, and pushing thousands of little foaming wavelets ahead of them, they plunged under the bridges over which the train passed, so that the chill breath of them made their faces shudder.
That's the end of the book. I mean, if you're like a middle European Jew thinking about trains at this period, obviously there's a heavy element of foreshadowing.
Yeah, and the rest of his family were all killed in... He died first of tuberculosis, natural causes, but the rest of his family all died in the Holocaust. I was getting sort of paranoid and a bit feverish and reading this, which is probably the best way of doing it. If you ever do have a good bit of flu... off for a week. They're sitting down at the dinner, and by him there's a picture. They're meant to be passing out these pictures of the theatre, but the only picture he can get is of the presidential box, which is, there's this long description of this picture, but there is only one presidential box, isn't there? And that's a place of sacrifice and assassination. And then they're like all processed and sent off in this train, and it's all, and then they're all off in happy land, going off on the train to the Great Rock Candy Mountain.
But with the spray blowing into the carriage in some mysterious way through the open window.
And yeah, and as you say, there's a very obvious loading people onto trains after processing them in sort of wooden chalets. And also all of Kafka's stories end the same way. I mean, they don't literally all, but nearly all of them end in the same way, which is the protagonist is ineluctably drawn to, like, suicide brought on, or, like, it's executed... Right. With his own willingness. He willingly goes to his execution.
I think Kafka told Max Brod that it was going to end happily, didn't he? He told him...
I didn't read the introduction. That's a bit of an oversight.
So apparently he told him that he was going to end happily, and that this circus kind of
place where there is a job for everyone, there's a place for everyone, is also a place of people meeting again, and that actually he's going to be reunited with his parents. The alternative is that he's going to die, that this is going to be the scene of his death.
Yeah.
And I tend to think that it was meant to end badly. So I want to talk a little bit about the happy end of Franz Kafka's America, which is the name of an artwork by an artist called Martin Kippenberger, who was active in the 80s and 90s particularly. It's this enormous installation which, like, fills whatever room is available to house it. Kippenberger seems to have a strong sense of the absurdity of being an artist, a certain kind of, like, nihilistic posture. He has this amazing sculptural series called Die Familie Hunger, The Hunger Family. They're all of these, like, strange painted polystyrene statues, which in fact are all replicas of the statue which the deaf sculptor character is making in Hitchcock's Rear Window. She's one of the kind of picturesque characters which you can see out of the window that Jimmy Stewart looks at. At a certain point, someone says kind of hello to her and she goes, "It's called hunger!" It's like this big sort of weird sub-Henry Moore thing with a big hole in its belly. But there is this strange polarity in his work where I think that the obverse of this absurd work is this genuine faith in the possibility of something much more sort of utopian, but in a very fleeting way. And that's what he's identifying in The Happy End of Franz Kafka's America, which is, it's like a big, it's sort of like AstroTurf, this like huge expanse of AstroTurf. And it's like the interview space for everyone joining the circus of Oklahoma, in which there is a job for everyone and a place for everyone. And what that's represented by is by literally every kind of chair you can possibly think of, from the lifeguard's chair in a swimming pool to all of these kind of clown
enormous
chairs.
Enormous flying eggs.
Yeah. And you literally like have a table that's like a fried egg that goes round and round and round. You have two chairs on tiny railways which circle one another. There's this sort of strange, like slightly kit silver guard tower communicating with another one across an expanse
of
space.
If you don't mind me saying so, looking at the pictures, I can't imagine anything that is more you. It's got all these little boxes on sticks.
Yeah. So I want to theorise this a little bit. You know, we have these ideas of what a utopia is. It's a perfect society. Utopia, I think, tends to be in some form kind of bureaucratic. Like, utopia, if you live in utopia, you tend to live enmeshed in a machine, but it just happens to be a perfect machine.
Bureaucratic, at least in the sense that everyone has to be the same.
Obviously, people have, like, a justifiable suspicion of this idea and of what it kind of potentially leads to in one way or another. There's an idea which I think we can counterpose to it, which is from Michel Foucault, which is this idea of a heterotopia. And what Foucault meant by this is something much more fleeting, where you get to kind of stand outside of these forces which exert control over you, and you get to, in a fleeting way, adopt an identity which is outside of those systems of control. Having this moment where your identity is not structured by one of these great big bureaucratic systems in one way or another, you know, making you a consumer or making you, one or another of these assigned categories and roles. And what for me is kind of rather delightful in this artwork is the way in which it seems to propose this impossible but nevertheless rather lovely moment of resolution between these two ideas. Yeah, it's a utopia, but it's a utopia where literally everyone can be different, and there's a place for literally everyone, no matter how different they are.
Franz Kafka is an amazing writer. I was very impressed. I haven't read any of his work for probably 10 years before reading this. I think now I have a better knowledge of the time. It's very clearly at the edge of sort of transition into the long 20th century. Which had been going on for a long time, and I think he is a deeply unusual perspective. His literature is not like that of his contemporaries, his modernist contemporaries. I think it's very different. I think there is something in the literature which I find deeply bad, not bad as in it's a bad work of art, but It feels to me like he's pushing out poison. The memories that this invokes, and it is immensely evocative in me, I feel, when I was reading this, very deeply. It brings up memories of childhood. I'm not sure he really believes, or his heart is in this view of society. I think actually in some ways, he may be in some ways underneath an optimist. And his line of work is one which would expose one, particularly someone naturally of a slight depressive disposition, to an awful lot of the bad sides of life. If you're just turning up and watching, like, bureaucrats trying to do over people who've lost their hands of their insurance money, who are living in utterly grinding poverty day after day. He's bringing up these, like, situations where you're feeling awkward and crushed by, you know, alienated from society and miserable and lonely. But he's also then, like, cross-wiring all of the inappropriate stuff for you. He's always constantly cross-wiring, like, the affection of family with, like, creepy voyeuristic sexuality.
It's interesting because he doesn't finish it. What he was actually trying to say about America is rather concealed, or rather implicit.
Well, it's a period when America... Well,
this is the dawning of the American century, isn't it, at this point?
Actually, I think it was an opening of American possibility, but it was not yet the time... It wasn't a time when it was clear America was the future.
Yeah, he talks about this character. So he says that Josef Roth has a character called Svonimir in his early novel Hotel Savoy, in which there's this quote, he loved America. When a billet was good, he said, America. When a position had been well fortified, he said, America. Of a fine lieutenant, he would say, America. And because I was a good shot, he would say, America. When I scored bullseyes.
Yeah, and America was kind of amazing.
I don't think it was Kafka's intention to sort of reinforce that impression, though.
I don't think he's really trying to say very much at all about America.
Don't you think? I feel like the unfinished journey of the story is towards this kind of darkness, actually. Yeah. But which we never reach. And that's. But then also, I think it's kind
of... There's lots of darkness already, because, like, in America, there are, like, humans are turned into machines all the time. They are completely subordinate to tasks for which they have no autonomy at all. To behave not like a machine is to be damned.
Yeah.
And, I mean, the society he was in was horrible. It was horrible. It was a horrible... And he was a socialist. A very convinced, middle-class, successful socialist working in a job that actually I think he regarded as worthwhile and important.
I think for me, the thing is that you go through all of that and then you're sort of constantly coming out the other side of it into these experiences of beauty. It's a rather amazing thing. I think it's definitely worth reading. Well, how do you think we should end it?
America.
America. America. Well, that's it, isn't it? That's the end.
Yeah, bye.
All right. Thanks very much for listening.
Beautiful, beautiful Oklahoma, out where the wind blows so free. High on a hill or in a valley, that's where I'm longing to be. Beautiful, beautiful Oklahoma, I'm going back today.